This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Let's talk about what happened. From what we understand now as the official story. Okay? That's what we're going to do. We're going to go through the timeline of events and the tragic death of Charlie Kirk, the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Now that the dust has settled a bit and the fog of war has lifted somewhat, let's go back through what happened leading up to that day and where things are right now. Because there's been information every which place, as we all know, on this case, and it's very easy to go down rabbit holes of emotion this way or that way and every which way. This is not talking about anything political or your opinion about Charlie Kirk or anything. It is just the simple timeline of events as we're being told. Yes, I did put that in air quotes. Because it is. That is what it is. It's not my opinion. This is just what is on the record. So let's go through what is on the record. It begins, as so many stories like this do, with a town that seems insulated from the chaos of the wider world. St. George, Utah is the place I'm talking about. It's a quiet Red Rock Canyon town, quiet neighborhoods. City where church steeples rise as reliably as the desert sun. It's the kind of setting people imagine when they think of safe, steady lives. But on September 10th of 2025, that illusion obviously cracked in the space of a single shot fired from a campus rooftop. The nationally known podcaster Charlie Kirk was killed, and two young men who had been living together in that quiet community were pulled into a story that has since echoed far beyond Utah's borders. Prosecutors say the shooter was 22-year-old Tyler Robinson. In charging documents, they outline a case built from digital traces, physical evidence, and a paper note left under a computer keyboard. They allege that Robinson had spent a bit over a week planning the attack on Kirk's speaking engagement at Utah Valley University. Text messages, forensic reports, and surveillance footage tell a story that is not just about crime, but about choices. People made in private that ended in public violence. The filings describe a young man who, according to his own mother, had become more vocal about his opposition to Kirk's views. Arguments at home had become sharper. Robinson's mother later told investigators she feared her son's rhetoric was hardening. Yet there was no outward sign that he was planning to act on it. No arrest history, no previous violence. And then in early September, something shifted. In private messages, Robinson referred to engraving bullets with meme-like phrases, as though combining deadly intent with a kind of online performance. That detail, prosecutors have said, is central to understanding how seriously he took the plan and how deliberately he carried it out. On the morning of September 10th, campus cameras at UVU recorded a man approaching from the north entrance. The footage showed a black T-shirt printed with an American flag, a baseball cap, large sunglasses, head tilted down. Investigators noted an off gait, a stiff right leg, as though concealing a long object beneath his clothing. At around 12:15 p.m., the same figure climbs a railing, drops onto a roof, and moves to a prone position. In that instance, or in that instant, rather, what had been private talk became public action. A single shot rang out. Within minutes, the shooter is captured again on camera, this time running across the roof, climbs down, drops a long item, picks it up, and heads for the northeast edge of campus. Officers responding to the scene later find a bolt-action rifle wrapped in a towel in a wooded area. The weapon holds one spent round and three unfired cartridges. Forensic testing, according to the probable cause statement, matches Robinson's DNA to the trigger. Other parts of the rifle, the fired casing, two of the unfired cartridges, and the towel used to wrap it. On each cartridge are etched phrases, some absurd, some taunting. The prosecutors say link the ammunition to Robinson's digital chatter about engraving bullets. In a capital case, these kinds of tangible details, they kind of matter. They transform worlds into evidence. At roughly the same time the rifle is being recovered back in St. George, Robinson's roommate and romantic partner receives a cryptic message. Drop what you are doing, look under my keyboard. Under that keyboard, according to authorities, is a handwritten note. It reads, I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk and I'm going to take it. The note, later photographed by police, becomes a central exhibit. In the texts that follow, the roommate presses for answers. Robinson replies that he's sorry. He claims police grabbed some old dude first, says he had planned to retrieve the rifle, but the area is locked down, and frets about leaving fingerprints. When asked how long he'd been planning it, he answers, a bit over a week. He resurfaces, or references rather, the bullet engravings as memes, and then instructs the roommate to delete this exchange. In another message, he advises, if the police ask questions, ask for a lawyer and stay silent. In court, those lines underpin two separate witness tampering charges. In plain terms, prosecutors will argue that Robinson was not only committing a killing, but also trying in real time to erase its trail and coach a key witness. In cases of political violence, these communications can be as revealing as any physical clue because they show state of mind. They're not after-the-fact rationalizations. They're contemporaneous, typed on a phone while adrenaline is still high. While that text exchange is unfolding, Robinson also posts on a private Discord server under the handle linked to him. The message is blunt. It was me at UVU yesterday. I'm surrendering through a sheriff friend in a few moments. Major outlets later verify the post's existence on Discord and confirms it is cooperating with investigators. This, too, became part of the state's timeline. And by the evening of September 11th, the case pivots. Robinson's mother recognized a surveillance image released by police and believes it looks like her son. She and her father contact him. A family friend, a retired deputy, agrees to help arrange a peaceful surrender. Robinson walks into a Washington County Sheriff's office with that friend and turns himself in. In public briefings, Sheriff Nate Brooksby calls it a negotiated handoff. He says Robinson feared being shot if a tactical team tried to arrest him at home. Instead, he's taken into custody without incident. In the eyes of prosecutors, however, the surrender does not erase what came before, obviously. By then, investigators have the note, the text, the rifle, and the DNA. Search warrants executed at Robinson's residence turn up a spent shell casing with similar etchings and multiple shot-up targets, physical corroboration of the bullet engravings he discussed in messages. On September 16th, Utah prosecutors file a charging document laying out seven counts, aggravated murder with a victim targeting enhancement, alleging Kirk was selected because of his political expression. Felony discharge of a firearm causing serious bodily injury, two counts of obstruction of for hindering or removing a rifle and clothing, two counts of witness tampering for the delete this exchange and ask for a lawyer messages, and a violent offense in the presence of a child enhancement, noting that children under 14 were visible at the event. They threw everything they could at him, and rightfully so. They also flag their intent to seek the death penalty. In subsequent hearings, Robinson's defense team has asked for more time to process what they call substantial and voluminous discovery. They add two seasoned capital case specialists, Michael Burt and Richard Novak, signaling that they are preparing for a full death penalty defense posture. All of this is documented in court filings and reported by local and national outlets. And where is Lance Twiggs, the roommate whose messages and note now sit at the heat at the heart of this case, the filings refer only to the roommate, a biological male in a romantic relationship with Robinson, who provided the note and text. They do not name him. Media identified him as Lance Twiggs, and as of today, he is publicly characterized as a cooperating witness. And no charges have been announced. And in all reality, probably has nothing to do with this. Washington County sheriffs have said Twiggs was moved to a safe space very far away from St. George, a phrase that aligns with standard protective steps for central witnesses in politically charged cases. Friends interviewed by reporters described him as quiet, intelligent, a straight-A student who once fell out with his conservative parents over religion and lived for a time with another family. That doesn't make you a murderer. It doesn't make you a conspirer to a murder. It makes him someone who his family didn't agree with, and he didn't agree with his family. That's pretty common if you haven't been living in this world. Families have fallouts. Families have differences, especially over things like this. None of it makes him a criminal. Okay? Until there is evidence showing he had something to do with this, which there has not been. And if he had something to do with it, would you be handing over everything to authorities and raising a flag going, I got this, guys, you probably want this? No, you probably wouldn't be. He's not accused of wrongdoing in the charging documents. The FBI, according to those same friends, has interviewed people in Twiggs' circle about the moments between Robinson's alleged confession and the first police contact. The narrow window, minutes, not hours, is likely to be the focus at trial. But on paper, as of now, Twiggs is a witness. He's not a suspect. Forensic and psychological insight helps make sense of why these details matter. In capital prosecutions, what the state must prove is not just who fired the weapon, but intent, planning, and aggravating factors. That's why the note under the keyboard, the etched cartridges, the Discord post, and the contemporaneous texts to Twiggs appear in the charging narrative. They're not background color. They're the evidence prosecutors believe will show premeditation and a motive linked to the victim's political expression. In plain language, the state is building a picture of a young man who moved from online grievance to lethal action, narrating his own plan even as he carried it out. And yet, even as the evidence piles up, this remains a case about choices. Tyler Robinson's parents did not try to hide him. They reached out. They facilitated his surrender. The friend who drove him to the sheriff's office ensured it ended without another death. In a county where political violence, or in a country rather, where political violence often explodes without warning, those actions matter. They may be part of why this case, unlike so many others, did not become a larger tragedy. Today, Utah courts are preparing for a long, complex prosecution. Robinson is presumed innocent until proven guilty. I mean, he's on video. So, presume what you will. The state has announced its intent to seek the death penalty, but has not yet filed a formal notice. His defense team is gearing up with some of the nation's most experienced capital lawyers, and the roommate at the center of the story remains under protection, out of public view. Thank God. And a community that once seemed far removed from political bloodshed is left to reconcile how a campus went event in broad daylight turned into a national headline. The thematic takeaway from this timeline is not about sensational deaths and details, but about accountability. In a space of a few days, words became action. A private grievance became public violence. Texts, memes, and bullet engravings, items we might dismiss as online posturing, are now exhibits in a capital case. In St. George and on the UVU campus, the traces of what happened are still visible. A townhouse with lights left on, Amazon packages at a door, a rooftop now sealed off. The facts laid out in court filings are a stark reminder that violence of this kind does not emerge fully formed. It's built step by step, choice by choice. Understanding those choices is not just about one defendant. It's about recognizing the warning signs before the next rooftop shot is fired. And also understanding that just because someone has a different opinion than you or has different sexual preferences than you does not make them the enemy. From within. So let's understand that little bit too. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are listening to this podcast, or if you're watching us on YouTube, hit subscribe there as well. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.